The following is a production of Vanderbilt's Owen Graduate School of Management. For more information about Owen, please visit owen.vanderbilt.edu.
The airline industry, as we know, has become an integral part of our lives in our ever-shrinking world. Specifically, over the past several years, it has proven to be an exciting, competitive, and sometimes treacherous industry. Through that, Pinnacle Airlines has continued to realize stellar financial performance and has set the bar for outstanding customer service, and we are lucky to have with us here today three of the reasons for that excellent performance. As guests, Lorraine Grubbs-West and Joe Williams. Lorraine is the Vice President of HR, or Vice President of People, and Joe is the Director of Corporate Communications for Pinnacle Airlines. Notably, recently, Lorraine has released a book called Lessons in Loyalty, which talks about how a successful airline operates its people. Mr. Phil Trenary is CEO and President of Pinnacle Airlines and has been since 1997. In his tenure, he's been a catalyst for change and implemented guiding principles for the company. He has also successfully completed an IPO in November of 2003 and led Pinnacle to being named the Regional Airline of the Year by Professional Pilot Magazine in 2002. He's a member of countless organizations, civic organizations in the Memphis area, and keep in mind he does this while managing the business of moving over 10 million customers, transporting them per year. Please join me in welcoming our guests.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here. Pull up this afternoon, had a taxi from the airport. Didn't know exactly where the building was, so I pull up what I thought was the right building. A couple of folks were standing out there talking. And they were obviously lawyers. It took a long time to get the very brief directions how to get here. First part was, I'm looking for the Owen School, and they said, well, it's in a red brick building. I looked at this campus, and that covers a lot of folks. But anyway, 15 minutes later, they told me it's next door, and we got here just fine. It is an honor to be here, and it's an impressive group. Like, I got to tell you, it's not only an impressive group of people, but it's a little intimidating being here, because a lot of smart folks here. I went to Oklahoma State University, and all the science that went into that selection was it was the closest school to our ranch in Oklahoma. And I noticed here that when you talk about Vanderbilt and what you're doing, I saw the term world shapers. And you know, that's kind of interesting, but I think you guys would believe that, and I know that the leaders here really believe that. And our main concern is Oklahoma State, you know, when can we beat the Sooners? Is there any possibility of beating Nebraska? And how in the world are keeping going to Vietnam? This is something I really don't want to do. And the worldview has changed, and it's just fascinating to come to institutions like this where you've taken that to the next level and are really concentrating on what it means to be a global player, what it means to change things and to be a player into the economy that's emerging and what it's all about. So I'm very envious. You guys are in a wonderful place and know you're going to do very well. I had planned on using this. I think I scared Tim to death when I walked in here with this big folder. I promise I'm not going to talk all that much. But I tend, as Joe will tell you, I wander off the reservation once in a while and see hand signals, he's trying to get me back on topic. But seeing the lawyers made me think, and I did a little deal for some lawyers back in Memphis. And you know, CEOs have had a rough battle lately as far as an image thing. You've seen a lot of stuff about CEO compensation and ethics and all that stuff. And it's been suggested that perhaps CEOs have a bit of an image problem going right now as far as that position. Probably true, but the dudes I met coming in here, let me tell you, who would have a magazine called Super Lawyers? This is it gets better. This is the cover boy here, His Excellency. This is a New York Super Lawyers Metro Edition. So I tell you what, CEOs are doing okay in some regards relative to other professions they're going to name. Now, I'm sure you'll agree that we all have mentors, and as you each think about in your own mind who that would be, I know we'll all have our favorite. I think a lot of you, if you'd have to separate between your mentors from your your parents, those that took care of it, and your business side of it. For me, my number one mentors, my folks, and made a lot of difference. And you know, I grew up, as I said on the video, shot in Oklahoma, population 100. We had one television channel. And that was great because on that one television channel, one of my favorite shows, Scott King. And I doubt if anyone here remembers Scott King, but thank you very much. And it was, I remember being a great show, and I watched it every Saturday. And I have kids, and we take a lot of trips and things like that, so we had one of these video players in the car. And I found the collection of the complete series of Scott King. I thought, this is great. They're going to have the same benefit that I did growing up and get to know Penny and Uncle Sky and all this stuff. And, you know, your memory has a funny way of conditioning things because it's real bad. And when you look at it, it's some of the hokiest acting and some of the weakest plots ever. And I made my kids endure that. I said, well, that was my mentor. That's who I wanted to be growing up. I lived on a ranch, a small farm, and my first real guy mentor was as a pilot. And this airplane landed right in front of our house. There's no runway there, but it was a pasture. He landed. Fascinating guy. And he told me stories all night about flying and aviation, how great he was to be a pilot. And it occurred to me many years later that my hero, my mentor, the one who really made a difference in my life and made me go this direction, was A, lost, at least 40 miles from the farthest airport, completely out of gas. We had to drive to Pasco, Oklahoma, and buy some gas for him. And it was not particularly well groomed, so he had to kind of be careful who your mentors are, but it did make a difference. And if you look at our industry, you know, I was very lucky because I can't remember not wanting to be involved in this, as we said in the video. This is Lorraine's baby on the video, and I think she did a great job on it. But it is a passion business. And, you know, I remember laying my back in the backyard looking up, and they had the OB-36 back then. It's a huge bomber. It's one of the Cold War relics. And it had all these engines on it. I think it had six engines pushing and two jet engines each side. And just a monster thing. It had very distinctive kind of a drum beat from all the very slow turning props hitting the breeze. And the only thing I knew is I wanted to be up there someday. So I wanted to have something to do with that. And my choice of careers was a mechanic. Figured out that it's a little too hard to work on the things, so I should probably learn to fly them. Went from there to pilot, and that was not nearly as interesting as the management side of it. And as you look at our industry, the regional airlines, which Pinnacle is one of many, really started back in the 1960s in Hagerstown, Maryland. And it was to go from Hagerstown to D.C. And it's the first code share, Allegheny Commuter, $9 fare back and forth. And if you look at the people that really started this industry, it's every kind of rascal and renegade you can imagine. They were interesting, they were gregarious. If you look at the word entrepreneur, they fit that to a T. One of my favorite, a guy named John Van Arsdale, he's a real character. He wound up getting out of the business because it had a fairly large airplane at that time. It's called the YS-11, a Japanese-built commuter, probably exceeded 30 people, something like that. And the pilot didn't show up. And it was not uncommon in those days for the CEO, that's why I got started, I could actually fly when I first started back in the business in 1983. You could fly yourself, hop in, go, get a first officer, and off you go, load the people, go fly. John did that. Problem was, John had never seen a YS-11, much less been checked out in, much less had a license for it. It's a larger airplane, had to have a certificate. And so for all the wonderful parts of our business, we need to grow up a little bit. It wasn't as safe as it should be, it didn't have the service level it should. So we really had to evolve, and our company was a lot like that. It was called Lone Star. We started back in 1983, and it was so much fun, and it was so easy, and we were so proud of our reservation system. As a rows of shoeboxes, we had a shoebox for every month, a tag for every day, and a card for every flight. Never lost reservation, never had computer problems. It's like hotel business. You bought the seat, you owned it. Didn't matter if you want to show up, that was fine with us, but is your seat is going to go. We had a wonderful bagging system. You carry your own bag. Somebody came in and said, my bag's lost, and said, well, what do you do with it? Lisa Gerald was our ace captain, just a lovely young lady. And one of the first officer positions was to go up on top of the control tower in Ponca City, where they laid over for lunch, had lunch at, Rafael's or something like that, Mexican place still there. But Lisa, Captain Gerald, would go sunbathe during the breaks up on top of the control tower. So the first officer had the duty to go wake up Captain Gerald and go fly the flag. And anyway, we kind of grew up. And the number one thing that changed, there's a lot of us like that. There was my first meeting of all the regionals, like 140 regional airlines there. And the main thing that transitioned the airlines, the need for more control, but also the regional jet. If you look at the defining event that changed this from less professional and we paid for the Navajo aircraft we had, we probably paid average $150,000 a piece. You know, the RG is about $20 million a piece, so you need a little more discipline than what you're doing. But I know I'm in Nashville, beautiful city, great place to live. You have a little bit of music going on here. But, you know, Memphis really is a very, very cool place. I don't think Memphis gets nearly enough credit for all the good things that come out of there. Now, for example, I think most folks know that it's the home of the blues, the birthplace of rock and roll. We call it the home of American music. This whole country thing kind of got started back there, even though we don't get much credit for that. The modern-day supermarket, first one, Memphis, Tennessee. Mr. Sanders founded that. The Holiday Inns, first modern hotel, came from there. And the thing that's probably best known for, and by the way, it was the third largest music center in the world back in the 70s. Scott King, it seemed better than it was, I'm sure. But the number one thing Memphis is known for is it's the home to high-speed logistics. And that's something I know everyone here really knows a lot about. If you look at the way manufacturing has evolved, and you know, FedEx is really more of a technology company than it is an airline by a wide, wide margin. I'm sure you've probably studied FedEx a lot. It's a fascinating company. It's really a world changer. That whole model has made a big difference. What you may not know is that Fred Smith is the father of the regional jet. He invented the thing. He didn't mean to. That was before deregulation. And Federal Express had all these Falcon 10s. It's a Falcon 20. I'm sorry, Falcon 20 is a mid-sized corporate jet. And they needed a larger aircraft, so he went to Bill Lear at the time that designed this aircraft that would accommodate, I think, a C-class container as the designation for it that would go inside this airplane. While this was going on, Canadair was a company that agreed to build the airplane. Fred was far more successful than dreamed as far as deregulating the package business. And all of a sudden, he didn't need Falcon 20s anymore, he needed 727s, a much larger aircraft because it evolved so quickly. Canadair was stuck with this airplane, didn't really know what to do with it because it was kind of fat for what they did, a little bit too big for corporate type application at that time. So it occurred to someone, it was an engineer named Eric McConaughey, that, wait a minute, if we put seats in this thing, we could have a small jet. So they did all the research, and they probably hired some Vanderbilt guys to go out there and take a look at it. And they said, you know, we think there might be a worldwide market for maybe 800 aircraft. And if we can build 400 of them, we make money. So they had all the development costs in this thing, already started developing tooling, so they built it. And today, we're over 2,000 regional jets. And it's truly revolutionized our industry. And today, the regional jets are 72% of all regional aircraft. And if you guys ever ask me back, you're kind of Memphis, we'll have a whole speech on the benefit of RJs and how it contributes to congestion and all that stuff. But the RJs have literally transformed our industry. If you look at what's happened to the reach, where we have airline service, the limiting factors out of congestion, you hear a lot about RJs clogging the sky. Well, you know, Memphis, Tennessee wouldn't be a hub if it wasn't for RJs. Cincinnati wouldn't be a hub if it wasn't for RJs. You go around the country, find all the cities, all RJs. What if we had to run all those people through, say, Chicago, Atlanta, LaGuardia, D.C.? You can imagine the massive effect that would have on congestion. So there's two sides to that story, and I'll go there another day. And Pinnacle, I think, is, if you look at the leaders in the regional industry, there's just a handful. And there's another company I admire a lot called SkyWest. And I consider them the main competition. I think it's us and SkyWest as far as being the high quality, the ones that can bring the most, that actually have a better product many times than the company they're flying for. And that's a real transition, because I got there on April Fool's Day, 1997. A lot of my, the people who work with will tell you that's prophetic. They show up on April Fool's Day. But it was a company that needed a lot of help. We had this small secret Ken talked about up there early on, 1985. We just had three cities. We got there, we probably had 54 total prop aircraft. We generated more complaints than all the carriers combined in Memphis, literally. The airplanes were red at one time. They turned pink. We called it the Mary Kay Fleet. The inside of it was good. It was awful. Our customers didn't like us. We had some great people. And we started with that turnaround plan. How do you take this thing and turn it around? Because we were not fork Y in the road. Like Yogi Berra said, if you get a fork in the road, take it. But we got to the, we could go this way, and it was do an orderly wind down. Because Northwest Airlines had to buy the company, it was in such trouble. My job was to close the transaction and either turn it around and do well or go down this path, which was what we call an orderly wind down. Well, you take the airplanes out a few at a time, because to take that much capacity out of the system all at once would have been devastating. So by taking control of it, if it didn't work out, you can pull it down. And we started looking at what to do, and that's where these guiding principles came from. And we have a saying called simply the best, and where that comes from is the way we established the new goals. We said we have to keep it simple because people have to understand. It does no good to come up with all the programs in the world, no one knows where it comes from. They can't really relate to it. I've been here putting a wheel on an airplane. You know, what does all this stuff mean? So the simplistic part was, we said, okay, who's the most reliable operator of Saab aircraft? That's what we flew at the time. Of Saab aircraft in the world. Because they keep those records. Okay, so when the DOT stats, who's the most reliable operator in terms of on-time completion? And we just set our goal a little bit above that. And that seemed out of reach at the time. But we put it out there, we measured it on a daily basis. We didn't know, and the term dashboard became quite in vogue later on, but we had dashboards, four dashboards were cool. And everyone knew what we were looking for. The mechanics knew what their turn time had to be. The folks at the customer service, they knew they had to turn their aircraft a certain amount of time. And that was really the basis for it. You had the cultural piece, which here's the guiding principles. You had the goals piece on the other side. And, you know, when you start measuring things and start reacting in a positive way, good things happen. And culturally, it was interesting because we had a lot of not very positive things going on in the organization with our people, with the performance. And one of the first things we did was said, I liked it. We're at the customer service meeting, and these people were mad. You know, the company's on the verge of bankruptcy. There's a lot of things that have gone and fixed. People were just angry. You know what the first question was? And let me give you one more press that question. Minimum wage was a standard. No. We were below minimum wage. Because airlines have a carve-out under the Railway Labor Act. You only have to pay minimum wage. So we were below minimum wage. Guess what the first question was? We want a time clock. I was stunned. Why do they want a time clock? Because people were cheating. And the really good people were having to do their job plus the job of everyone else there. We had turnover in the first 6 months of 40% of that group, the group who wanted to turn the time clock. Guess what? The good people never left. They stayed, and they became the foundation of the culture. It was their, they built it. It was theirs. And that became one of the best performing groups. Today, not only do we handle ourselves in a lot of places, we actually contract out and handle other folks. So, you know, very key in the turnaround was developing a culture that our people did. We had this thing called IPMAD, which is a goofy way of saying input that makes a difference, like a focus group, except management is not allowed to be in it unless they're invited. Our people identify a problem, and it worked all the way across the company. Our turn times and maintenance, the flight control quality, all those things skyrocketed through this process. So it was a real key to that. We turned it around, started doing great, got regional jets, everyone's happy, tremendous growth. Had the initial public offering, took the company out as one of our goals to come away from Northwest. And somewhere along the way, we had this little thing called a bankruptcy at Northwest. And one of the difficult parts of our contract with Northwest, they wanted us to, we were worth more outside of Northwest when we were embedded. And when I went there, I didn't go there to work for paycheck for Northwest the rest of my life. We recognized there's more value outside Northwest, but major carriers love control. and no one loves them more than Northwest Airlines. And it's very difficult to see having this asset pulled out and lose the direct control. So we won our freedom, so to speak, took the company public, but there were many, many, many hooks in the contract. To do business with other carriers is very onerous. We went ahead to have to develop an entire another certificate, we had to be walls. And it's very daunting. And we committed to do it as part of turnaround plans to build this other certificate. So the company led the industry. Oh, by the way, on the goals I was talking about, we became the world leader within 8 months on the Saab. We remained that one until we got rid of the airplane. We've had the RJ since 2000. There's maybe been 3 months in that entire time we haven't led the entire industry of all 2,000 airplanes out there in performance. So that stuff, we still use it today. But Northwest bankruptcy comes along. And I spend a lot of time talking to analysts. And on the roadshow, I don't know if anyone's been on a roadshow here in some of your work. Anyone here been on a roadshow with the IPO? Okay, you know what it's like. It's one of the most exhausting, thrilling, fun, maddening things you'll ever do in your life. It's great. It's one of those things that I don't really want to do another one, but I wouldn't have missed it for anything. It's just great. It's just meeting. I forget how many cities over 14 days. You live in an airplane in the backseat of the stand taking phone calls. You're either talking to analysts or on conference calls in between. And it's the only time I've ever had any idea what it's like to have a handler. And a lot of these celebrities and folks like that. Well, it wasn't because we were in hot stuff. It's because the schedule is so tight, you don't have time to think. You literally get out of the car, right, and here's who you're talking to, here's their interest. You get back in the car, they hand the phone to you, the number's already dialed, here's who's on board, here's what they're thinking about. You get briefed on the airplane, you get to the hotel, they're staying there, hand the hotel room key, your bags are already unpacked, because you're going to be in the room about 2 to 4 hours before you do it all again, starting next morning in the city. So it's just fascinating, but anyway, I digress. Thank you, Joe. The whole point was that we're too important to Northwest Airlines that if Northwest Airlines ever goes bankruptcy, we'll be okay. We'll be the first contract to be affirmed because we're flying about 37% of all Northwest Airlines flights. Along to us. And there's no way they would do anything to hurt us. Guess what? I was wrong. Northwest Airlines goes into bankruptcy. One of the first things they did was reject our contracts and say, we're putting all your business out to bid. And it was devastating. If you can imagine from when you have a lot of people working for you, and we have between 5,000 and 6,000 folks working with us now, as you start looking at your life, as you start making business decisions, what is the most important thing to that employee? How does it affect me? You know, how does it affect my kids? How does it affect my life? And so people get scared. Uncertainty is a terrible thing. And we look at that and say, wait a minute. Because we're the most reliable operator in the nation, because we have very competitive cost, because we have our guiding principles, when you get into them, our customer service thing's pretty easy. It's clean airplanes and carry people. Real simple. Because airplanes look better than anybody else's out there, because of all these reasons, guys, we're going to make it. And through some very, very difficult negotiations, we had our net profit cut in half. We got a new contract. We had life, and we survived the near-death experience, but our profitability was cut in half, about $40 million cut in profits. But what are we going to exchange? It's still a negotiation. You know you're in bankruptcy. You still have to negotiate. And what we got in exchange for that was this thing called governance, and we had a classic golden share, preferred share. We called golden shares, classic preferred. It gave Northwest a lot of governance rights, seats on the board and things like that, the nose under the tent all the time. We got rid of that. In fact, we'll officially buy the share in January, $20 million. Northwest has no input at all. More importantly, we negotiated the right to fly for others. We acquired a little company called Cody. Well, today we have 5 customers. We'll be growing a lot this year. We're launching new aircraft types. And so while bankruptcy is a very difficult thing, the point I want you to take on this is if you have your people behind you, have very well thought out goals, it's very clearly defined, that everyone can understand, and you're a leader in your industry segment, you'll probably be okay. It doesn't mean you won't go through some hardship along the way, but you're going to survive to fight another day. And so we did that. Today we have over 1,000 flights. We fly to 150 cities nationwide. We have five customers. You're going to see we typically lead the DOT. Aloha and Hawaiian are the only two carriers that usually beat us in on time and completion. We're going to stink this quarter, not our fault. But it really hurts us reputation-wise. And the reason I say not our fault, Minneapolis went through runway construction, and one of the things you go through with a senior partner, if they have a choice between letting an Airbus go with 160 people or letting a regional jet go with 40 to 50 on it, guess which one wins? It's the right decision. It's the right business decision. So I had this runway shut down most of summer. We got to sit a lot, which counts as a cancellation on us. It doesn't penalize us with our customer, so we were okay financially, but it does hurt from a profitability standpoint. One of the things we're using as our going forward strategy, we're looking for very efficient aircraft to grow, 50-seaters. There's plenty of them out there. We need to get larger aircraft. We have bought 16 of the CRJ-900 aircraft, which is up to a 90-seat aircraft. We have it configured for Delta with 76 seats, first-class cabin, very roomy in back. It's a very green aircraft, very fuel efficient. That's one thing we talk about in industry, and I'll talk more about in a minute, is we had to be more efficient. The other aircraft we had is very interesting. We talked about this at lunch, and they gave me a lot of good stuff to think about at lunch. And I'll try to squeeze a little bit of this in. But there's an analyst that is well quoted. In fact, he's not really an analyst. He's more of a give papers quotes for money guy. And he said, turboprops are dead. This is like 3 years ago. Dead. Read my lips. D-E-D. Which says something. But anyway, yes, your father's turboprop is probably not very popular right now. That's not the most comfortable ride, but this new generation turboprop's coming out. And we're banking heavily on an aircraft called the Q400. It's in operation now, mainly in Europe. There are a few of them here up in the Northwest. It's an airplane that we can basically put 78 people in. We'll have ours configured for 74, so they have more room. And run 400 miles an hour. It's as quiet as a jet. You don't have the vibration. And we can fly for the same trip cost. It's a 50-seater. So you take that combined with the ability to save fuel down low. We're telling the story at lunch. We basically made a pitch to Continental Airlines and sold it on the premise. You look at Newark Airport, we have a lot of congestion in that entire segment of the Northeast. We walked into the room and said, we'd like to present you today with a new runway at Newark. How do you do that? There's a little crosswind runway in Newark. It's too short for a jet to use. It doesn't line up with the wind well. And this airplane is certified so it can land with up to 26 mile an hour tailwind. So 90%+ of the time, we'll be able to land and take off the same direction. You have the highways in the sky you hear a lot about. We don't have to go up there and get in those. We can do our own custom routes in and out of there because fuel burn, it doesn't hurt us to stay low. We can stay in the mid-teens. All we have to do is get above the turbulence, stay in the smooth air. And so we start that in January, and our modeling projects that we think will come true is anything under 500 miles, within a 500 mile radius around Newark, we'll outrun the jets, and in a weather event, we'll be coming and going when everyone else is in line because we have our private runway, take off and land, come and go to the gate. So you'll hear a lot more about that. I think it's going to be very successful. The other thing you're going to see, the unducted fans, airplanes that have a jet engine on them have all kinds of blades on the back of them, props, basically. Because fuel has become so important that it's going to come back again. One of the things that comes up a lot is, and again, you guys have such great thoughts at lunch, is why have carriers gone bankrupt with legacy carriers? It just seems like an awful business model, and it is very difficult. And CEO Magazine, 2 years ago, declared that the network carriers, it's a flawed model, and didn't say they're dead, but it was the same sentiment that it doesn't work, not going to be around. The Wall Street Journal said the network strategy is flawed, it doesn't work. Well, guess what? I'm sure that around here you've talked a lot about networking, and I don't care whether it's data or gas or seeds. The network, so far, is still the most efficient way to move things from point A to point B. Think about it. If we put a telephone on this podium right here, and we ran a line to every single home in this country, the wiring bundle couldn't fit in this room. But because we network, it works pretty well. Same way with airplanes. If we took the network system out, about 60 to 70% of the airports would lose service tomorrow. Well, why is that? Because there's not enough people on both ends of it for people to fly back and forth to. Southwest Airlines, where Lorraine came from, I love Southwest. It's a great model. It's not really a low-cost carrier. It's a point-to-point carrier. You know, Southwest flies from point A to point B. JetBlue is point-to-point. Frontier is trying to be a little bit of both, which you're seeing the network carriers realizing that their whole model came out of regulation. Again, that's another whole speech. Very inefficient. They're having to act more and more like the new low-cost carriers, Southwest, JetBlue, AirTran, those guys. The point-to-point carriers, or if they want to be called low-cost carriers, that's fine, because the model does limit itself to low cost. The low-cost carriers are having to move towards more of the network philosophy. Now, if you look at Southwest, you know, Herb Keller would love to brag about his low cost, and there's nothing more fun than to give Herb Keller a bunch of crap about almost anything. And if you look at it and say, well, Herb, that's because you don't have to worry about moving anyone from point A to point C, which, by the way, Southwest Airlines now does. Because if all you have to do is go from point A to point B, what's the first premise? Enough people have to live there to want to fly. So the low-cost carriers, they skim the cream off the top, the cherry pickers. God love them. And this is a great country where to do that. They only fly to places where there are people. Like Sam Kinison used to say, a solution to world hunger. They'll move to where the people are. I mean, have the people move where the food is. And the same thing with Southwest Airlines. They only flew to where you had lots of people on both ends of where it could justify those points. And if you look at the network, as you pull this together, Memphis, Tennessee, you know, Nashville is very jealous of our hub in Memphis. They really are. And when American Airlines was here, that was most of you are too young to remember that, but it was a really big deal because Nashville had all the air service, and Memphis had Southern Airways and the Republic. If Memphis didn't have a hub, they might have 20 to 23 nonstop destinations in Memphis. That's it. I don't know how many destinations Nashville has, but it's not a real large one. It's more than that, but it's not huge. Memphis, Tennessee, which especially economically, is a very, very small city. It's the smallest hub city in the nation. And if you apply some sort of economic factor to it for the income in our city, it's much smaller even than the population suggests. But Memphis has nonstop service to 93 cities, including three international destinations. Because why? You manufacture connections. And there's a cost built into that to make sure the bags go back and forth in airplanes. Because we can't come and go anytime we want to. If you want to fly from New York to Chicago, trust me, people are going to be there anytime they want to come and go. Memphis, Tennessee, it doesn't work like that. But the connections, you have to have all the airplanes show up at the same time. So we have to coordinate where everyone shows up in time to move all the bags, all the people, and get back out again. It's not very efficient. It's a very efficient way to produce seats. It's inefficient from the labor and capital investment from the ground facilities. So this whole thing about network carriers being good and all that, it's just a bunch of bunk. Network's still the best way to do it. It's great because competition has helped us all. And what Southwest, JetBlue, Frontier, everyone has done is push costs down. We were talking about that you know, if you go back not that long ago, it's inconceivable that you can fly for what you fly for today back in the 70s. It's far more expensive than it is today to fly airplanes from point A to point B. To sum it up, you know, it's a fascinating industry. I love it. You look at what Pinnacle Airlines has done, it's a great example of what can happen when teamwork really works. It's a great example of what companies do when they're threatened. You always get a lot closer. Delta Airlines would be totally messed up today and not U.S. Air try to take them over. And what brought that company together was somebody from the outside coming to pick on them. And folks said, wait a minute, you know, you can mess with us if you want to, but this is our company, and we're going to make it work. And that was the defining line when Delta Airlines decided to make it work. You know, if I had to sum up our industry, things are getting better, a lot better. There's a lot of challenges. There's fuel, there's labor. Again, I could talk to you another hour about all that. But I always like to close these with my favorite all-time airline quote. And it's Captain Eric Moody. He's with British Airways. He's flying a 747, and they've just flown through a cloud of volcanic ash. He comes on the PA, and it's absolutely true. It's on the voice recorder. He said, ladies and gentlemen, we have a small problem. All four engines have stopped. We're doing our damnedest to get them going again. Hope you aren't too terribly distressed. So that's kind of where we are today. We've had all the engines fall off. We have at least two of them going again. And with any luck at all, we'll have four going out to distant future. So thank you very much. Really appreciate it.